There is no such thing as the social production of reality on the one hand, and a desiring production that is mere fantasy on the other. The only connections that could be established between these two productions would be secondary ones of introjection and projection, as though all social practices had their precise counterpart in introjected or internal mental practices, or as though mental practices were projected upon social systems, without either of the two sets of practices ever having any real or concrete effect upon the other. As long as we are content to establish a perfect parallel between money, gold, capital, and the capitalist triangle on the one hand, and the libido, the anus, the phallus, and the family triangle on the other, we are engaging in an enjoyable pastime, but the mechanisms of money remain totally unaffected by the anal projections of those who manipulate money. The Marx-Freud parallelism between the two remains utterly sterile and insignificant as long as it is expressed in terms that make them introjections or projections of each other without ceasing to be utterly alien to each other, as in the famous equation, money equals shit. The truth of the matter is that social production is purely and simply desiring production itself, under determinate conditions. We maintain that the social field is immediately invested by desire, that it is the historically determined product of desire, and that libido has no need of any mediation or sublimation, any psychic operation, any transformation, in order to invade and invest the productive forces and the relations of production. There is only desire and the social, and nothing else. Even the most repressive and the most deadly forms of social reproduction are produced by desire within the organization that is the consequence of such production under various conditions that we must analyze. That is why the fundamental problem of political philosophy is still precisely the one that Spinoza saw so clearly and that Wilhelm Reich rediscovered. Why do men fight for their servitude as stubbornly as though it were their salvation? How can people possibly reach the point of shouting, "More taxes, less bread"? As Reich remarks, the astonishing thing is not that some people steal or that others occasionally go out on strike, but rather that all those who are starving do not steal as a regular practice, and all those who are exploited are not continually out on strike. After centuries of exploitation, why do people still tolerate being humiliated and enslaved to such a point, indeed, that they actually want humiliation and slavery not only for others but for themselves? Reich is at his profoundest as a thinker when he refuses to accept ignorance or illusion on the part of the masses as an explanation of fascism, and demands an explanation that will take their desires into account. An explanation formulated in terms of desire. No, the masses were not innocent dupes. At a certain point, under a certain set of conditions, they wanted fascism. And it is this perversion of the desire of the masses that needs to be accounted for. Yet Reich himself never manages to provide a satisfactory explanation of this phenomenon, because at a certain point he reintroduces precisely the line of argument that he was in the process of demolishing, by creating a distinction between rationality as it is or ought to be in the process of social production, and the irrational element in desire, and by regarding only this latter as a suitable subject for psychoanalytic investigation. Hence, the sole task he assigns psychoanalysis is the explanation of the negative, the subjective, the inhibited within the social field. He therefore necessarily returns to a dualism between the real object rationally produced on the one hand, and irrational, fantasizing production on the other. He gives up trying to discover the common denominator or the coextension of the social field and desire. In order to establish the basis for a genuinely materialistic psychiatry, there was a category that Reich was sorely in need of, that of desiring production, which would apply to the real in both its so-called rational and irrational forms. The fact that there is massive social repression that has an enormous effect on desiring production in no way vitiates our principle. Desire produces reality, or stated another way, desiring production is one and the same thing as social production. It is not possible to attribute a special form of existence to desire, a mental or psychic reality that is presumably different from the material reality of social production. Desiring machines are not fantasy machines or dream machines, which supposedly can be distinguished from technical and social machines. Rather, fantasies are secondary expressions deriving from the identical nature of the two sorts of machines in any given set of circumstances. Thus, fantasy is never individual, it is group fantasy, as institutional analysis has successfully demonstrated. And if there is such a thing as two sorts of group fantasy, it is because two different readings of this identity are possible, depending upon whether the desiring machines are regarded from the point of view of the great gregarious masses that they form, or whether social machines are considered from the point of view of the elementary forces of desire that serve as a basis for them. Hence, in group fantasy, the libido may invest all of an existing social field, including the latter's most repressive forms. Or, on the contrary, it may launch a counter-investment, whereby revolutionary desire is plugged into the existing social field as a source of energy. The great socialist utopias of the 19th century function, for example, not as ideal models, but as group fantasies, that is, as agents of the real productivity of desire, making it possible to disinvest the current social field, to deinstitutionalize it, to further the revolutionary institution of desire itself. But there is never any difference in nature between the desiring machines and the technical social machines. There is a certain distinction between them, but it is merely a distinction of regime, depending upon their relationships of size. Except for this difference in regime, they are the same machines, as group fantasies clearly prove. When in the course of our discussion above we laid down the broad outlines of a parallelism between social production and desiring production, in order to show that in both cases there is a strong tendency on the part of the forces of anti-production to operate retroactively on productive forms and appropriate them, this parallelism was in no way meant as an exhaustive description of the relationship between the two systems of production. It merely enables us to point to certain phenomena having to do with the difference in regime between them. In the first place, technical machines obviously work only if they are not out of order. They ordinarily stop working not because they break down, but because they wear out. Marx makes use of this simple principle to show that the regime of technical machines is characterized by a strict distinction between the means of production and the product. Thanks to this distinction, the machine transmits value to the product, but only the value that the machine itself loses as it wears out. Desiring machines, on the contrary, continually break down as they run, and in fact run only when they are not functioning properly. The product is always an offshoot of production, implanting itself upon it like a graft, and at the same time the parts of the machine are the fuel that makes it run. Art often takes advantage of this property of desiring machines by creating veritable group fantasies in which desiring production is used to short-circuit social production and to interfere with the reproductive function of technical machines by introducing an element of dysfunction. Armand's charred violins, for instance, or César's compressed car bodies. More generally, Dalí's method of critical paranoia assures the explosion of a desiring machine within an object of social production. But even earlier, Ravel preferred to throw his inventions entirely out of gear rather than let them simply run down, and chose to end his compositions with abrupt breaks, hesitations, tremolos, discordant notes, and unresolved chords, rather than allowing them to slowly wind down to a close or gradually die away into silence. The artist is the master of objects. He puts before us shattered, burned, broken-down objects, converting them to the regime of desiring machines. Breaking down is part of the very functioning of desiring machines. The artist presents paranoiac machines, miraculating machines, and celibate machines as so many technical machines, so as to cause desiring machines to undermine technical machines. Even more important, the work of art is itself a desiring machine. The artist stores up his treasures so as to create an immediate explosion, and that is why, to his way of thinking, destructions can never take place as rapidly as they ought to. From this, a second difference in regime results. Desiring machines produce anti-production all by themselves, whereas the anti-production characteristic of technical machines takes place only within the extrinsic conditions of the reproduction of the process, even though these conditions do not come into being at some later stage. That is why technical machines are not an economic category and always refer back to a socius or a social machine that is quite distinct from these machines and that conditions this reproduction. A technical machine is therefore not a cause but merely an index of a general form of social production. Thus, there are manual machines and primitive societies, hydraulic machines and Asiatic forms of society, industrial machines, and capitalism. Hence, when we posited the socius as the analog of a full body without organs, there was nonetheless one important difference, for desiring machines are the fundamental category of the economy of desire. They produce a body without organs all by themselves, and make no distinction between agents and their own parts, or between the relations of production and their own relations, or between the social order and technology. Desiring machines are both technical and social. It is in this sense that desiring production is the locus of a primal psychic repression, whereas social production is where social repression takes place. And it is between the former and the latter that there occurs something that resembles secondary psychic repression in the strictest sense. The situation of the body without organs or its equivalent is the crucial factor here, depending on whether it is the result of an internal process or of an extrinsic condition, and thus affects the role of the death instinct in particular. But at the same time, they are the same machines, despite the fact that they are governed by two different regimes, and despite the fact that it is admittedly a strange adventure for desire to desire repression. There is only one kind of production, the production of the real, and doubtless we can express this identity in two different ways, even though these two ways together constitute the auto-production of the unconscious as a cycle. We can say that social production, under determinate conditions, derives primarily from desiring production, which is to say that homo natura comes first. But we must also say, more accurately, that desiring production is first and foremost social in nature, and tends to free itself only at the end, which is to say that homo historia comes first. The body without organs is not an original primordial entity that later projects itself into different sorts of socius, as though it were a raving paranoiac, the chieftain of the primitive horde, who was initially responsible for social organization. The social machine or socius may be the body of the earth, the body of the despot, the body of money. It is never a projection, however, of the body without organs. On the contrary, the body without organs is the ultimate residuum of a deterritorialized socius. The prime function incumbent upon the socius has always been to codify the flows of desire, to inscribe them, to record them, to see to it that no flow exists that is not properly dammed up, channeled, regulated. When the primitive territorial machine proved inadequate to the task, the despotic machine set up a kind of overcoding system. But the capitalist machine, insofar as it was built on the ruins of a despotic state more or less far removed in time, finds itself in a totally new situation. It is faced with the task of decoding and deterritorializing the flows. Capitalism does not confront this situation from the outside, since it experiences it as the very fabric of its existence, as both its primary determinant and its fundamental raw material, its form and its function, and deliberately perpetuates it in all its violence with all the powers at its command. Its sovereign production and repression can be achieved in no other way. Capitalism is, in fact, born of the encounter of two sorts of flows, the decoded flows of production in the form of money capital, and the decoded flows of labor in the form of the free worker. Hence, unlike previous social machines, the capitalist machine is incapable of providing a code that will apply to the whole of the social field. By substituting money for the very notion of a code, it has created an axiomatic of abstract quantities that keeps moving further and further in the direction of the deterritorialization of the socius. Capitalism tends toward a threshold of decoding that will destroy the socius in order to make it a body without organs and unleash the flows of desire on this body as a deterritorialized field. Is it correct to say that in this sense schizophrenia is the product of the capitalist machine, as manic depression and paranoia are the product of the despotic machine, and hysteria the product of the territorial machine? The decoding of flows and the deterritorialization of the socius thus constitutes the most characteristic and the most important tendency of capitalism. It continually draws near to its limit, which is a genuinely schizophrenic limit. It tends with all the strength at its command to produce the schizo as the subject of the decoded flows on the body without organs, more capitalist than the capitalist and more proletarian than the proletariat. This tendency is being carried further and further to the point that capitalism with all its flows may dispatch itself straight to the moon. We really haven't seen anything yet. When we say that schizophrenia is our characteristic malady, the malady of our era, we do not merely mean to say that modern life drives people mad. It is not a question of a way of life, but of a process of production. Nor is it merely a question of a simple parallelism, even though from the point of view of the failure of codes, such a parallelism is a much more precise formulation of the relationship between, for example, the phenomena of shifting of meaning in the case of schizophrenics, and the mechanisms of ever-increasing disharmony and discord at every level of industrial society. What we are really trying to say is that capitalism, through its process of production, produces an awesome schizophrenic accumulation of energy or charge, against which it brings all its vast powers of repression to bear, but which nonetheless continues to act as capitalism's limit. For capitalism constantly counteracts, constantly inhibits this inherent tendency while at the same time allowing it free rein. It continually seeks to avoid reaching its limit while simultaneously tending toward that limit. Capitalism institutes or restores all sorts of residual and artificial, imaginary or symbolic territorialities, thereby attempting as best it can to recode or rechannel persons who have been defined in terms of abstract quantities. Everything returns or recurs. States, nations, families. That is what makes the ideology of capitalism a motley painting of everything that has ever been believed. The real is not impossible, it is simply more and more artificial. Marx termed the twofold movement of the tendency to a falling rate of profit and the increase in the absolute quantity of surplus value the law of the counteracted tendency. As a corollary of this law, there is the twofold movement of decoding or deterritorializing flows on the one hand, and their violent and artificial reterritorialization on the other. The more the capitalist machine deterritorializes, decoding and axiomatizing flows in order to extract surplus value from them, the more its ancillary apparatuses, such as government bureaucracies and the forces of law and order, do their utmost to re-territorialize, absorbing in the process a larger and larger share of surplus value. There is no doubt that at this point in history the neurotic, the pervert, and the psychotic cannot be adequately defined in terms of drives, for drives are simply the desiring machines themselves. They must be defined in terms of modern territorialities. The neurotic is trapped within the residual or artificial territorialities of our society and reduces all of them to Oedipus as the ultimate territoriality, as reconstructed in the analyst's office and projected upon the full body of the psychoanalyst. Yes, my boss is my father, and so is the chief of state, and so are you, doctor. The pervert is someone who takes the artifice seriously and plays the game to the hilt. If you want them, you can have them. territoriality's infinitely more artificial than the ones that society offers us, totally artificial new families, secret lunar societies. As for the schizo, continually wandering about, migrating here, there, and everywhere as best he can, he plunges further and further into the realm of deterritorialization, reaching the furthest limits of the decomposition of the socius on the surface of his own body without organs. It may well be that these peregrinations are the schizo's own particular way of rediscovering the earth. The schizophrenic deliberately seeks out the very limit of capitalism. He is its inherent tendency brought to fulfillment, its surplus product, its proletariat, and its exterminating angel. He scrambles all the codes and is the transmitter of the decoded flows of desire. The real continues to flow. In the schizo, the two aspects of process are conjoined. The metaphysical process that puts us in contact with the demoniacal element in nature or within the heart of the earth, and the historical process of social production that restores the autonomy of desiring machines in relation to the deterritorialized social machine. Schizophrenia is desiring production as the limit of social production. Desiring production, and its difference in regime as compared to social production, are thus endpoints, not points of departure. Between the two, there is nothing but an ongoing process of becoming, that is, the becoming of reality. And if materialist psychiatry may be defined as the psychiatry that introduces the concept of production into consideration of the problem of desire, it cannot avoid posing in eschatological terms the problem of the ultimate relationship between the analytic machine, the revolutionary machine, and desiring machines.